Well, hey there, freaks. It's your boy Marty here to introduce this week's sponsor. I'm not sure if you heard of them yet. They've been around for a bit, though. The Cash App. This week's episode of Tales from the Crypt is sponsored by the Cash App, the number one finance app in the App Store for the last 2 years. You freaks already know, the first P2P payments app to allow you freaks to buy Bitcoin. One of the best UX flows in the Bitcoin buying world, in my opinion, right now. On top of this, they have their Boost program, which allows you to get a Boost card, and that's tied up with a bunch of merchants. You get your card, you get your personalized signature on it, and you go to places like Whole Foods, Taco Bell, Chipotle, your local coffee shop. The list goes on. I believe they added more merchants earlier this week. I got a notification. You go there, you use your Boost card, you get a little savings, and you can use those savings, stack some sats. Maybe one day they'll have sats back. Who knows? So go to the App Store, the Apple App Store, or the Google Play Store today and download the Cash App.
Tales from the Crypt.
What is up, freaks? Welcome back to Tales from the Crypt. We're chugging along here on Hell Week in New York City, Blockchain Week. Sitting down with a very special man, a man of many skills, open source software advocate, creator of Green Address, and now the chief architect at Blockstream. I'd like to introduce you freaks to Lawrence Nahum.
Hi.
Welcome to the podcast. I just butchered your name after you told me how to say it.
Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Fanboying. I've been a big fan of Larry Bitcoin on Twitter for a while. I've been putting out good information, and it was it's been cool sitting here for the last 5 minutes hearing your story of how you came to Bitcoin. Let's jump into that. So how did you find Bitcoin? What were you doing before you found Bitcoin, and sort of what drew your attention towards this?
Right. So my background is computer science, after I finished university, I mostly worked in finance, OTC, electronic confirmations, and that sort of thing. I think I heard of Bitcoin maybe even in 2011 or beginning of 2012 on Slashdot, and I sort of ignored it because it sounded better than overselling, and most comments on Slashdot were very negative. But then at some point later, 2012, I heard about Silk Road. And I was surprised that drug dealers would accept Bitcoin, because usually, they like hard cash. And so I started investigating Bitcoin a little bit more. I finally got to read the white paper, and that made the whole difference. Once I read the white paper, I was like, okay, I don't understand everything, but I understand enough to know that this is truly different, and it makes sense too. And so I started, going down the rabbit hole of reading more. And I know that key management is really a tough issue, and I know that it's trivial to get malware on your computer, whether it's a game or something else that you install. And so when I understood that you could do multi-sig on Bitcoin, I was really excited, and I thought, how can I take advantage of multi-sig, to make a more secure wallet, and maybe even offer a more advanced functionality on top of it. And that's what where Green Address comes from.
Mm-hmm. The Green Address, it's been around for a while. One of the first multi-sig solutions, or mass multi-sig solutions that's easy for people to use. So what was it about multi-sig solutions that lured you in specifically? Was it something about the clearing products you were working on before, or was it simply...
Oh, the fact that I simply don't trust one single device, mm-hmm. especially a generic computer, an online generic computer. And so I thought, if I have two, then you really have to compromise both, which really makes it harder. Nowadays, I think, it's that's not the hard, it's easier to just lose your coins than get hacked, mm-hmm. to be honest. But at some point, and already today, people get targeted. And so, the more security, the better.
Yeah. No, that's the $5 wrench attack. That's an existential fear that's on the top of every Bitcoiner's mind. But I do think losing your coins is probably more likely than thinking me not.
Especially for average end user, right? They forget where they wrote the piece of paper with their backup words, and maybe they lose their device, and it's a sad story that we hear every so often.
And I don't know if I want to live in a future where where the world's just attacking Bitcoiners and trying to steal their money. Yeah, I go back and forth at whether or not that dystopian LOP-centered future, OPSEC-centered future comes to be. I don't know. You have any thoughts on that?
I mean, it's already happening today even without Bitcoin, right? Like, they try to get your credit card data, they try to get maybe your username, passwords, and other information.
But that's all done online, right? I'm talking about, like, the physical attacks.
Sorry?
That's all done online, though, right? Mostly, like, credit cards sold on dark market.
Right.
Information sold on dark markets. I'm talking about more like physical.
Oh, physical attacks on Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, you shouldn't really disclose how much you have. You shouldn't really, I don't know.
Don't tell people you own it.
Huh? Yeah, maybe.
No, it seems like to go on a little tangents here. So I saw you were hanging with a Bitcoin sign guy last night.
I was.
What was that freak up to?
I don't know. I changed the place like 3 times last night, and I ended up in a place where he was there. He's a really cool guy. I really like him. He's also fun and smart. He was like, let's take a picture. And I was like, yeah, let's do it.
It was a very intimidating picture.
It is. He wanted the guns out, and we got the guns out.
So it's like your avatar on Twitter. It does not do your beard justice at all. So seeing that picture, I was like, whoa.
I know that picture is from the Bitcoin Embassy in Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. And behind me, there's a photocopy of, the newspaper that ended up on the first block, in the Genesis block.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so that's why I have that picture there, because I love it. I love to have that. I usually shave every couple of months. It's just when it gets too long, I'll shave.
I become a beard man myself. That's just easier.
Yeah, easier. Just trimming it is more work than just trimming the whole thing.
Yeah. No, it's a good way to signal, like, hey, I'm in Bitcoin. I don't give a fuck what you think about me, you know?
There's some of that. There's some of that.
So how did you start a Green Address? How did you come to work at Blockstream, become the chief architect of Blockstream?
It's a very interesting question. So the rabbit hole, it's not like it has an end. So starting Green Address was just a way for me to, like, in hindsight, I was clueless when I started. I knew enough to do it, but it wasn't done maybe the perfect way the first time. In fact, the Green Address that you see today is fairly different to the first iteration. We were using bare multisig, you know, before P2SH was a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But no wallet supported that format, so it was really hard to send into the wallet in first place. You needed to use raw RPC and that sort of stuff. That's not going to be a very user friendly wallet, right? No. And also, I learned that you don't want to reuse addresses. And so BIP32 just came out. I was like, okay, we have to use BIP32. So I rewrote it a couple of times before it came out. And it has been a continuous learning experience. And at some point, I got really excited that the Blockstream company was formed, because they were planning to work on very interesting things, interesting tech. I'm very interested in privacy and fungibility. And the idea of confidentiality on chain and making it harder for people to see what you're doing or how much you're spending, I think it's great. And so back then there was a test sidechain called Elements Alpha. Mm-hmm. And we decided to support that in Green. I think we were the only wallet at the time that supported the sidechain tech.
Mm-hmm.
With confidentiality on our end user wallet, and we started talking because it was a good marriage in a way, because Blockstream didn't have a wallet team, and and I really wanted to work with the people at Blockstream, people like Adam or Peter, Andrew, and so on and so forth.
Seems like a ragtag group of all-stars you got there at Blockstream. So Blockstream Green, let's talk about the specifics of the wallet. So it's a 2 of 2 multisig. This
2 of 2 and 2 of 3.
And 2 of 3, if you want to. Initially, or...
Yeah, the default is 2 of 2. But you can create a 2 of 3 sub-account, which is separate. And then you have two out of the three keys.
Is Blockstream ever not going to sign the second key?
Sorry?
Is Blockstream ever not going to sign the second key? That's what people
Yeah, that's a deal. Well, actually, that's not true. That we had that at the beginning, the instant functionality, but that was opt-in. Mm-hmm. So we will co-sign it again if you didn't opt-in in the instant. But we deprecated the functionality, actually. Because, you know, with lining and whatnot, it's not as needed as I thought it was when I created Green Address. And so we will co-sign as long as you provide the right two-factor authentication and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and then you have the time lock function as well, too.
Yeah.
Can you describe that? Because that's a pretty cool, creative way to set up this wallet structure.
Yeah, so basically we're actually changing it soon. But let me explain what we do today. All the addresses that we generate are a multisig script, P2SH multisig script of 2 of 2. And as soon as you either receive something from outside or maybe make some change, make a transaction and have some change, we send you an email with an encrypted email with pre-signed transactions that at least sign our side of the transaction. They're locked. They have a time lock such that they can only be broadcasted, assuming that the other party signs, the user signs. They can only be broadcasted after some time. I think the default is or was 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is if you lose your two-factor, the service disappears, you take this pre-signed transaction, you add your signature, you wait the time lock, and then you broadcast them yourselves. And those send to your single side of the key. So at that point, you are in full control. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, you're always in full control. It's just that you have the time lock.
No, that's the interesting thing about these wallets and products built on top of Bitcoin is you get sort of a range of optionality of how you want to engage. And if, again, it's all about trust models and trade-offs. And this is a very unique sort of trade-off I think you guys found at Blockstream Green and Green Address.
Yeah, I think at the time was the best you could do. Nowadays, there's better options. You can use CSV, check sequence verify, so that you don't have the window of trust where you have to trust the server to send you those pre-signed transactions. Because if the server was to target you and not send you those, then you know you'll be on the hook. So with CSV, the addresses have the spendability option of the user on its own. Embed in the address, so your wallet, as it generates, it knows that you're if not now, later you'll be the only one being able to spend them on your own without any window where you could get attacked or targeted.
And do you think the if Schnorr signatures does get implemented at some point in the future to make these schemes even more creative?
It would be much better for Green once we have that, because then we can be on the chain. We will look exactly like a vanilla Bitcoin single sig transaction. Mm-hmm. People wouldn't know that you have the multisig security, which means you're leaking less information. But also it's cheaper because the way Schnorr works. You can basically add signatures together and they weight as much as one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that it sort of incentivizes people to engage in Schnorr signatures and make Bitcoin a little bit more private at the protocol level.
Exactly. Now, for us, because we want to use the CSV and maybe we want to hide some of these conditions when you don't use them, maybe we want to wait for Taproot as well.
Mm-hmm. That's a good... thanks for providing a great segue into BIP Taproot. Peter Wille, obviously, when he dropped that 2 weeks ago, what are your thoughts on that particular proposal and its likelihood of getting merged?
Well, I don't see why not. I don't see the I don't see too much controversy there. Obviously, you never know, and I didn't see any controversy with SegWit, to be honest. So
no.
true. Yeah, I didn't. But then I think the ecosystem is also very different from where we were when SegWit came out. And I think many more people than back then are keen on privacy and fungibility. So I think there's a strong push towards having these improvements added.
If you were able to sort of design the soft fork and the way in which it gets merged, how would you sort of design the signaling for this upgrade? Hate to put you on the spot.
That's a interesting question. Well, I would do something like allow the miners to signal readiness in a window, say, I don't know, a year, 6 months, whatever it is. And then some sort of USF sort of activation after another 6 months. So if the miners are willing, it happens earlier. If it doesn't, if they're not, it happens slightly later.
My mind's a little fuzzy going back to this BIP 91 and segue. They signal that in the version bits or...
Yeah, well, the version bits at the moment, I think, are a little bit abused.
Mm-hmm.
Miners are throwing in their stuff to grind, you know, the blocks. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you notice, but sometimes when you run Bitcoin Core, you see the version number looks wrong, or, you know, the last few blocks have such and such wrong version number. I don't know, you know, what's going to be used, what's best. But I think a mix, you know, more or less what we did with SegWit, but defined from day one, as opposed to, you know, yelling at the miners.
Mm-hmm. And I am but a lowly podcaster and newsletter peddler, but I've been saying that if BIP Taproot in particular, that proposal gets merged, it seems to me at least, I don't know, I'm dumb, that Bitcoin is less replacing parts after that and more tightening screws. Like, you're not replacing ECDSA with Schnorr, adding Taproot Groot and stuff like that. Is that a fair assumption, do you think?
Well, this is the last set of changes?
No, not the last set
of changes.
Yeah.
Not sure.
No.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing is built for extensibility, right? The dress, the scripts, the versions, I don't know. I mean, there's quite a few smart people, and you know, there's also Graphroot, and there's a few other proposals that maybe can go in later. After more people, you know, think more about them.
Yeah, but Graphroot's in the BIP Taproot proposal, right?
I thought it was separate.
Is this?
It's a separate thing.
No, I'm wrong. No. What are your thoughts on ossification? Like
ossification.
That's another like a.
I'm for it.
Yeah.
I mean, even if Bitcoin was taken before SegWit and locked there, I'll still love Bitcoin. Even if Lightning wasn't invented, I still love Bitcoin. And I still think that, you know, it's not like because we have Lightning that now we don't need to increase the block size. That's regardless of Lightning. You know, you need to keep it down to a reasonable fashion so that, you know, it's easy, relatively easy for people to synchronize and keep up and whatnot, regardless of the L2, L3, you know, scaling layer solutions. Those are just, you know, ice on the cake.
Right. Just added benefits.
Yeah, just other benefits that we're getting, and great that we have them.
No, that, yeah.
They're not you know, solution to everything either, right?
Yeah, no, and that was actually interesting watching an interview that Adam had earlier this week. I forget what I think it might have been, like, to Block TV, and he was talking about how traders sort of deprecate the use case of Bitcoin at the protocol level by trading, and talking about how you can move certain use cases to layers like Lightning and Liquid in particular. So let's jump into Liquid and how you guys are. But have you been working on Liquid outside the?
A little bit. Mean, I worked on it on Green side, on the Explorer side. I've been working on helping out with building the releases and testing the releases of. You know, Liquid is based on Bitcoin Core. We recently rebased to a recent version, and we recently added support for the Qt wallet, so the GUI from Bitcoin Core. And there was quite a bit of effort in, you know, testing it and making sure that it has all the features needed to, you know, visualize the issued assets and so on and so forth. I've also built a couple of tools on top of Liquid. I did the bridges for Liquid. Liquid is a federation, so it's not like it's a entirely peer-to-peer network, like where people can come in and live like in Bitcoin, right? When there is no known set of participants or whatever. So with Liquid, is a federation, and I basically created some bridges so that anyone can connect to the network, not just a federation member. So I worked a little bit on that, and the Explorer. The Explorer, you know, has Bitcoin support, Testnet support, and Liquid support. So, and I must say, I learned a ton about Liquid in the last year. Mm-hmm.
So how does Liquid leverage the assurances of Bitcoin at the protocol level, and what sort of new functionalities does it allow for people using that sidechain?
I can say the main features are pretty much confidential transaction, confidential asset. What does that mean? That means that when you send a transaction, only the sender and the recipient can see the amounts, and maybe some auditor if you choose to, you know, to disclose to them, you know, your blinding keys or information such that they can decrypt the data and verify for themselves. Now, the chain enforces that, you know, you're not inflating or creating Bitcoins out of nowhere. And the team went, a step ahead also did confidential assets. So that's to say that it's almost like the amount, but it's for the asset type. So now you don't know how much I'm sending and of what. Mm-hmm. Only the sender and receiver know, and auditors, if there are any, if you choose to, you know, give them the opportunity to verify. Confidentiality is, I think is very important, and it's good for traders as well. It helps in preventing things like front running. You know, there's every so often there's people go on Reddit and Twitter. Oh, I saw so many Bitcoins move to Bitfinex. So many Bitcoins move to Coinbase. So someone is about to dump them. Mm-hmm. And now I already have coins on the exchange. And I know the exchange is going to take 3 comps or 6 comps or whatever before they crazy the guy. So I'm going to act before he does and front run him, mm-hmm, or something like that. With Liquid, it's going to be a little bit harder because you don't know what I sent and how much I sent. And so you can't use that data.
Yeah, the whale report bot is helping people front run these whales all over the internet. And it's crazy watching this stuff evolve and become more sophisticated over time. As Bitcoin is like an expanding universe that we discover like the limits of as more blocks are produced and more people are using it and sort of figuring out the pain points and finding unique solutions, creative solutions to these. It's been crazy to watch how creative, number one, people are getting on top of this. And so do you think this is only the beginning of the creativity that we can sort of leverage on top of Bitcoin?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it is just the beginning, right? I cannot really say with precision, but I feel like, when Google just came out and we were all using Alta Vista and whatnot?
I was so young, yeah.
Right. Is where I feel like maybe we're even earlier than that. I'm not sure, like comparatively.
I remember AOL Kids. That was like my first internet.
Do you remember Hasta La Vista?
Hasta La Vista, no.
It's a search engine for cracks for applications.
Oh.
Like, to piracy and stuff.
Okay. Yeah, I was probably too young. I was probably pirating Rugrats episodes or something like that back in the day. But you are you're a man of many talents. You co-host a podcast, The Reckless Review, with Udi.
Yeah,
that's been fun to watch you guys put that out. You're putting that out what, every 2 weeks?
Every 2 weeks. Well, we're not very professional and we're not very good at keeping the schedule. And especially recently, I've been very busy, so it's been very hard to find the time we were both good. Plus, I have 2 kids, 1 on the way, 2 dogs.
Congrats.
So it's very hard to find time.
Yeah. You and Udi are also working on something very cool, AB Core.
Yep.
Which allows you to run a Bitcoin full node on Android devices. And thank you for working on this. This is something that we always say decentralization is an ideal that we strive for. And I think things like this help us get closer to that ideal. So what was sort of, obviously, we want more people to run full nodes. Why did you decide Android devices, and why did you and Udi attack this problem?
Now it went kind of backwards. Mm-hmm. Someone gave me an Android TV for Christmas. I have no use for, I don't watch TV, so I'm gonna install Linux on it. I did, but then it didn't really work well because of binary drivers, Wi-Fi. So I had, okay, I have to go back to Android. to have the network working. Because on Linux, I can run Bitcoin Core like no problem. There's ARM binaries, no issues. And Android is Linux, but it's a bit different. It's not your average Linux distribution. It's a specialized Linux distribution. It has a different C library. Linux usually uses glibc. Android uses Bionic or ulibc. So there's a few differences. Enough to make it complex to run software on both interchangeably. And so I installed Android again, and I was like, okay, but I want this thing to be useful in a way or another to run my full node. So I'm going to have to get, you know, the ARM Bitcoin Core binary is running on this thing. So the first thing I did was really, really hacky. This was 3 years ago, actually.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, yeah. It was really hacky. I was actually taking the binaries from the Arch Linux repositories and Debian Linux repositories and downloading those plus all the dependencies of those binaries, so like hundreds and hundreds of megs, dumping them in a directory. And I don't know if you're familiar with chroot.
No.
But it's basically like you can fake that you're inside a Linux operating system,
okay,
inside a Linux operating system by just saying this directory is like my root. Assume that that's like a new computer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of worked. It was really, really hacky. Kind of worked, but it broke the DNS peering. So when your node starts the first time, it connects to some DNS seed servers. They will tell him, you know, here's some IPs and some nodes that you can use to, you know, to synchronize the blockchain and whatnot. And there's a bunch of volunteers running them. Plus, there's some hard-coded nodes, fallback hard-coded nodes in the client. And so the it was hacky. The DNS part wasn't working, so it was always going to use the fallback nodes. And it was crashing on some variety of Samsung and LG. Because I put it out almost immediately. I did it in a weekend, put it out almost immediately. It was very bad at the beginning. It used to crash all the time. And
that should be expected, right?
Yeah, kind of. But then I took a completely different approach. I looked at how others were like Orbot. How are they running Tor properly on Android? How is there's another project called I think Debian chroot. Mm-hmm. How are they running on a vanilla Debian distribution on Android? So I kind of reverse. It wasn't really reverse engineering because it's all open source. But I had a look at that, and I took a different approach. Instead of downloading binaries from the Linux distribution, I built them myself with the Android Native Development Toolkit, also called NDK. And that was a mission. I had to actually patch a lot Bitcoin Core. And every time I did this, I would do a PR to Core to bring my patch up stream. So the next time there's a new release of Core, I wouldn't have to patch it again.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly, with a lot of help from Wumpus, Vladimir, but also others, I started upstreaming some of these changes, and now the diff is minimal. It's basically configuration. And we have a very tiny binaries, 3 megs. And now we even added Tor support.
I saw that.
Udi contributed a couple of PRs recently. That were really good because they made it runnable on some other devices that wasn't runnable on before. And so I took the opportunity to say, hey, do you want to help more? You want to be the co-maintainer? Why not? Help me. I don't have enough time.
No, it's so talking about the latest update, you have Tor, and then you leverage Luke Jr.'s new Bitcoin P2P links.
Yeah, it's URL format. I had that idea three years ago. I had an issue on AB Core to create this QR code thing. But I didn't really investigate until recently. And actually what triggered me was Luke with that thing. I was like, okay, he's doing it. It's what I wanted to do for a long time.
So can we describe this to the freaks out there?
Yes, sorry. This is a URI format, like you can have HTTP or Bitcoin dot column, like you have for addresses, BIP21 links. Basically, it's a URI handle that you can use to give to software that needs to connect to a full node, the address and port, and it works with you know, ClearNet as well as Tor, Onion. And so you put that link into a QR code, and then you can have a wallet, scan it, and you know, rather than talking to random peers on the internet, rather than talking to a server, you can talk to your own full node at home. And what's cool about Tor is that, with Onion especially, is it allows you to do NAT pass-through. It allows you to, even if you don't open the ports on your router, it allows you to make your node reachable by you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it does.
That's because that's the big UX problem with Tor, right, is opening your ports.
You mean with Bitcoin, not with Tor?
Well, I think it's harder. For both, right? Well, Bitcoin, you want to open up your 833 ports so other people can pull the blocks from your node. With Tor, too, isn't like another UX similar thing?
With Tor, you only need to open the port if you want to be a relay node, yes, or if you want to be an exit node.
Yes.
But otherwise, you don't.
Would you want to be? That's another thing. Like, Bitcoin's going to
be... Well, you should, right? Yeah. Like, the Tor network can do it somehow, right?
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't be just leeching. I think Pierre, I never pronounce his surname right. Rochard?
Rochard, yeah.
Right. He's very keen as well.
I think that's right. You know I'm bad with last names.
Yeah. I think he's the first one to say we really should, it's good to open up all these Tor, Onion, firewall bypass nodes, but ultimately we're relying on relay nodes, on Tor relay nodes, and we need to create more of those if we want this to work.
Yeah, exactly. It's some Matt O'Dell and I have been preaching on Rabbit Hole Recap is we're going to be leeching off this network pretty heavily, it seems, as Tor. We put our Noddle node behind Tor recently, and that is something, as Bitcoiners running full nodes, we should probably run Tor relay nodes as well.
Yeah, you should. I think you should. Unless maybe you're in one of those places where, it maybe goes against your safety, or it's illegal, or so on and so forth. Maybe you want to avoid that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's...
So there's a variant of this protocol that I would like to do.
Let's jump into it.
Excuse me?
Let's jump into it.
Yeah. So this thing I just described, it really only works with full nodes that are not pruned. Because a pruned node won't have the information that you seek unless you told it to watch for it in advance, ahead of pruning. So what I think we should also have is one of these, this is called Bitcoin - peer-to-peer, the protocol that Luke created. I think we should also have a Bitcoin - RPC. Now, there's a lot of debate, in the space about, oh, don't expose the RPC on the internet. That's terrible. And I completely agree. However, at the moment, there's no way to have a prune node that you can connect to remotely and also tell it what to watch for, because you cannot do that through the peer-to-peer port. Now, if you use something like Onion V3, you can have encryption, authentication, so on and so forth. So you can actually protect the RPC beyond the RPC user password, because keep in mind that RPC is all in clear text. So even if you have a password, if someone has your Wi-Fi,
they can get it.
Or your ISP, they can get it. With the Tor V3 Onion addresses, they cannot. So then you have two layers of protection. It's the Onion encryption and then also the password. And so that way you could have a very lightweight wallet on the go, and even multiple people around the world using the same server, like say one family or a business, they can use one node at home, and then they all connect to it, they tell you what to watch for forward. And whenever they need to spend or verify that they received something, they query the RPC, and they do so in a authenticated, encrypted, safe way.
Is that the future of Bitcoin decentralization that you envision, is having like a smart member of the family maintain the node, having everybody else connect to it? And
this is a very good question, because
AB Core is like a project that's working to get a full node in a lot of people's hands. It seems like this is something that that you're passionate about.
Yeah, I envision people running their own full node at home. I don't think they need to run more than one, unless they don't trust their family, which is, fair enough, possible. We need to make it simpler. But what I really like about the AB Core is that Android is so available, right? There's everyone has at least an old mobile with Android, and they're fairly powerful. Like most mobiles are more powerful than a Raspberry Pi, and there's people running nodes on Raspberry Pis, right? So you know, it's a cheap, easy, convenient way, and also it's harder to target you because there's, you know, a guy buying an Android phone or an Android tablet or an Android TV, it's unlikely to be that he's buying it to run AB Core, you know, all 10 of us. But someone buying a full node, whether it's a CAS or a nodal or not, well, it could be a little bit more targeted because I'm buying this for, you know, Bitcoin purposes and so on. You know, you could put bad software on it or and so on and so forth. Now, there's an argument that goes for, well, if you're shipping hardware and I'm trusting you and I'm trusting your hardware anyway, then you may as well send it pre-synced. I think Casa does that.
Casa does that, yep.
I don't know if anyone else does that. And you heard about...
Samsung's come about to do it, right?
Samsung?
Samsung, with their new HTC.
No, wait. HTC is a company. Samsung is another company.
Oh, yeah. It's HTC. Like, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm confused.
No. Yeah. But HTC is doing AB Core.
Mm-hmm. They're using AB Core?
Yes. That's what they're using. We've been talking last week.
Congrats on that, then.
It's always sorry. They don't need to ask permission. They just take it. But they were nice enough to, you know, get in touch and chat and discuss the pros and cons. How can we make this better, improve? And the device is kind of powerful. It you know, it has 6 gigs of RAM. It's you know, that's 6 times more than a Raspberry Pi, as far as I recall. So it's quite a bit of a beast. And yeah, they were asking about prune mode. They were asking whether it makes sense to pre-sync it or not. They were asking whether we should use the internal flash or the SD card, and the trade-offs, and how can we make it not drain the battery but keep it on 24/7.
It's nice to see they're asking these questions.
Yeah, they're smart. They're asking the right questions, and they're learning fast. They actually left me one of the devices so that I can help them tune it.
And they're going to pre-sync it first, right?
Sorry?
They're going to pre-sync it first.
Chris. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what they're going to do in the end. We're, I mean, even if they pre-sync it, the...
Just have to catch up to the tip.
Yes, and you could always go, okay, I want to do it from scratch.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're trusting the hardware. If they really wanted to do something to it, maybe they could have hidden in a boot ROM or something that, and you know, I don't know.
No, it's crazy. Like, again, we're talking about still the early days, but it feels like this year in particular, like a lot of good news is happening from the sort of incumbent industrial economy, like HTC, Square. Fidelity getting in. It seems like Bitcoin's reaching a level of legitimacy in the eyes of the normies, if you will.
Yeah. So about the QR code and the Bitcoin peer-to-peer link, I added to AB Core, but at the same time I added to Green. So now you can scan that QR code on Green and link it to your full node. And so the way we use that with Green, it's still connect to our server because we have the multi-sig stuff and there's no way around that. But we basically check that the server is not lying. So the balance you see there, it's Green address is not telling you rubbish. It's actually yours. Then you check it by talking to your own full node. But what I'm actually doing in the background as well is I'm working on single sig for Green, and so that will rely on a full node somewhere, and then that could either be AB Core or it can be something else. Mm-hmm. It could even be on the same device, and that means you basically have a front end to Bitcoin Core, but for Android, which is kind of cool.
That's crazy.
Because we can basically use an entire set of GUI for Green, but instead of using our servers, just only talk to your own full node. That's it.
Mm-hmm. What type of use cases do you think this opens up? Because obviously it frees people up from having to be.
Well, as I told you earlier, I like privacy. I like security. I like privacy. I like virus things, but also like security, and so that's why multi-sig was my first thing.
Foray.
But we had tons of people that also want other options. So I always hid behind, well, I want a generic multi-sig. I wasn't really hiding behind it. It's just that, you know, it takes time to do it properly. And by generic multi-sig, I mean you want single sig, you go single sig. You want N of M, where the N are variable, and it's not fixed. Like, it is right now with 202 and 203 only. So I wanted that originally. But turns out that doing single sig was a weekend project. And we're not, it's not done, but it's very close.
Just a weekend project?
Maybe 3 days.
And so you're testing it out right now? Or?
We're testing it, yes. Yeah, my, as you know, I like to go. I like to do things iteratively. So the first was a little bit of a hack. I'm using Bitcoin Core's wallet and just using the RPC, and that works well. But I actually want the key management to happen in the mobile wallet, mm-hmm. not in the remote node. That was just a test to prove that things worked. Yeah, because I want to use mnemonics and BIP39. I don't want to use you know, Bitcoin Core doesn't use that. It uses hex seeds mm-hmm. or wallet.dat, you mm-hmm. know. And that's not as convenient for backup purposes. I like the, you know, 24 words.
Yeah, no, I do as well. It's very easy. It's very normie friendly as well.
Yeah.
No, so I like that you said that your building is like an iterative process. I'm a big fan of baptism by fire as well. Just sort of jumping into the fray and start building stuff. So obviously there's more attention around Bitcoin. It's getting more attention from developers in particular. Do you have like any advice to somebody approaching Bitcoin development or building tools on top of Bitcoin? It could be daunting for some people, but as somebody who's been building for years.
Imposter syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
We all have it. And, you know, you just got to start somewhere. So I think my first PR was removing a single white space from a readme in Bitcoin Core.
Really?
And someone said, what the hell are you doing? What is this PR? You're wasting your time. Like, come on. You. That was my first one.
It's baby step.
Yeah, baby steps. In general, you have to really read a lot and know that there's someone better than you out there, always.
So what are your sources for reading? Are you going to?
Well, I love OpTech. Mm-hmm. So that's relatively new, right? It has been out for what, a year now?
Yeah, around, I think the issue 47 went out yesterday, so a year and 5 weeks.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And they're amazing. I love what they're doing. So that's a great starting point. There's far more bootcamps than there everywhere when I started. There's a bunch of people online.
Justin Moon, Jimmy Song.
Yeah.
21 lectures in Switzerland, I believe. Yeah, they're popping up all over the place.
Yeah, so one of those, go to one of those, learn hackathons. But it's really bouncing ideas with other people. Mm-hmm. Like getting other people to review your code and to, you know, to tell you off, to tell you how bad it is. Mm-hmm. And then to listen and to try to understand why they're telling you what they're telling you.
Is it a big ego check, this development process?
I was set straight many years before at another company.
What happened?
Well, I was working with this guy that was he wasn't officially my mentor, but unofficially he was my mentor, mm-hmm. because every time I made a change and he didn't like it, he would tell me, and he didn't have to tell me. It wasn't his role to tell me, but he would tell me, and he would tell me in an angry way, but not really angry, but you know,
curt way.
In a way that would teach me what was right and what was wrong. And basically, you know, you should always be humble when it comes to code, and there's always something you may have missed. I mean, bugs are all over the place. So yeah, this guy was a, you know, I think he was a big Wine contributor. Wine is now an emulator. And you know, he taught me everything I knew about programming, pretty much. Because everything I knew before, you know, starting that job was basically university experience, which is really rubbish. I mean, rubbish compared to, you know, the levels requested to be a proficient developer. University teaches you, you get an idea, you get to try, but you're not professional yet.
No. Like you said, it's an iterative process. You got to go try to build shit, right?
Yeah, and basically code reviews is something that doesn't happen in every company. If you get a chance to have your code reviewed, please do, because it's an amazing learning experience. Another thing I like is pair programming. I don't get to do that very often, but, you know, occasionally. And it's a pleasure, because you learn tricks and other things that other people do and you don't.
What's the best practice for pair programming? Are you, like, video conferencing, sharing screen, or are you able to hop in, like, an editor with each other?
The best thing is sit on the, you know, close by. But obviously, in today's age of people working remotely, it's fairly hard. What I do with some members of my team is we have a server somewhere. We SSH into it, and then we use TMAX in shared mode.
Okay.
TMAX is a screen multiplexer, so you can have multiple shells within one screen, one console. But the nice thing is that you can detach and, you know, go on your way, take the tube, go back and reattach yourself, and you're back to where you were. So if you had a long-standing process running or some Python script running, it's still there running and you don't lose anything. And you can have multiple people connecting to it and multiple people typing at the same time. And so you can say, oh, okay, you drive now or I drive now. And ideally, you also do with voice.
Who's who's your favorite person to pair program with?
Oh, I don't have one.
You don't have one?
No, no.
You learned something new from everybody?
Yes, from everybody. Definitely, yes. That's,
I mean, as again, as a lowly podcaster, newsletter coding is always fascinating to me because, again, it's unique to the person who's writing the code, right? And everybody has a different way, and these languages can be manipulated differently. And
Different editors. And yeah, to be fair, pair programming itself is not trivial if you're not using the same tools. Because then it's a little bit harder to follow or to know what's going on. But, you know, many people in the space use Vi or Vim, and they're familiar with shells and scripts and SSH and whatnot. And so, you know, once you have lingua franca of sorts.
Yeah. Is there consolidation going on in the software world, like in lingua franca? Is it, or people consolidating on a certain dev environment? Or
Not really. I mean, there's people using all sorts of editors, all sorts of... there's still a big war with Vi, Vim, and Emacs.
Do you think it's good it's that way?
I don't think we're going to get away from that, no. Yeah. There's more editors coming out... There's a very good one called Pi. Well, I don't know because I only use Vim, or Vim. But there are very good editors, I hear. What I don't like about editors is that they help you too much. And so when you don't have it, then you become paralyzed.
What? With the autofill function? Or
That sort of thing. Search, autofill, click here, and I take you to the definition. No, I don't like that because when I'm on a server and I'm debugging and production is crashing, I have none of that. You know.
It forces bad habits.
Yeah, yeah. I need to keep my my brain trained on...
your mental acuity.
Yeah.
Lawrence, thank you for sitting down. We only have 45 minutes here.
Thank you for having me.
I could go on for like another hour with you, but do you have any final thoughts on the current state of Bitcoin? Are you optimistic, pessimistic about the future? And a tidbit for the freaks out there, a word of advice?
I'm optimistic. I would like to ask you if I can ask. I basically would like more ABCore contributors. Even if you know you're not strong on the coding side, maybe you can help on the documentation, or maybe you can help with guides, or maybe you can help with the GUI, or maybe you can help you know, teaching people. So that's the message I would like to.
Well, I know Matt Odell started syncing his ABCore node on one of his Android devices. I think it was right after the P2P links. He saw they were integrated and runs on Tor. So we'll definitely be talking about it on Rabbit Hole Recap. And
that's cool.
Freaks, yeah, if any of you are listening to this and think you contribute to ABCore, what's the depository on GitHub?
Repository. It's github.com/greenaddress/ABCore.
Okay.
ABC or.
Well, again, Lawrence, thank you for sitting down. It's been a busy week. I'm sure you got a busy day ahead of you. You got a big party tonight.
Oh, yeah. The Dragon's Party.
It's where, is this where you guys unzip your human suits and the lizards come out?
Again?
No, again, thank you. I'll see you tonight.
Cheers.
Enjoy the rest of your day. Peace and love, freaks.